Welcome to another Indefatigable episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts, Andrew, David, and Jen. This week, we read Identity Crisis by Brad Meltzler, and now the cast begins.
All right, everybody, welcome to another single-tiered episode. That sounds weird. It sounds like there's levels. Of Atomic Powered Supercast. My name is Andy, and I'm hanging out with Jen.
Hey.
David.
Hey.
And we're kicking off our arc called DC's Crisis, Letdowns.
So before we get into that, can I say something?
Yes.
Okay, so last week we had the episode about Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yes.
Since then, it has been announced that there will be a new Guardians of the Galaxy ongoing.
Ooh.
Written by Bendis, I think.
Oh, Brian Michael. When does it start?
I don't remember. It's part of... It's going to... I think January? And in addition to that, there's going to be a new Nova ongoing series written by Jeff Loeb.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so... I figured that was pertinent since we just had that episode.
So then read the rest of it. That way you'll be ready for that when it happens.
Mm-hmm. So the Guardians of the Galaxy doesn't have the same lineup. The cover has Drax, Gamora, Rocket, Groot, and Iron Man. And then I think Star-Lord. There's a guy, like a normal-looking person on it. I think it's Star-Lord, but I don't remember.
Like how it's like, which of these things is not like the other?
Yeah. And then there's Nova, but it's not Richard Rider. It's this new guy named, I think his name's Sam Alexander. He has appeared here and there in like recent comics. Like he was in the final issue of Avengers vs. X-Men. And so at the end of the issue, Thor offers him a spot on the Avengers too. But
snap.
So I think he's gonna, to me, he feels a little Jaime Reyes Blue Beetle kind of. Like he's a teenager from the Southwest who gets a space artifact and becomes a superhero.
That is Jaime Reyes, I think.
Except I don't think he's Hispanic.
Oh, wow, almost.
Yeah, Jeff Loeb's pretty. He's a good writer, and I think Ed Guinness is the artist. Don't quote me on that. I could be totally wrong. But yeah, I'm pretty excited about it.
We'll post some info on our Facebook page. People can go there and check it out.
Okay. So, anyways, sorry, Andy. You can continue podcast.
Thank you, sir. So, this week we read Identity Crisis. It ran from June to December of 2004, which is kind of like happy 4th of July, here's your rape comic, and then Merry Christmas, here's your evil wife comic. It was written by Brad Meltzler, with pencils by Rags Morales and inks by Michael Blair. I don't think we've ever credited an inker before, but he's like on the cover of all seven individual issues.
Have here and there. We need to be better about it, but
we really should be better at, like, crediting the penciler, the inker, and the colorist, if they're all independent.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think what I want to do for this series, because this is, like, we're doing three titles. We're doing Identity Crisis this week. The next week we're doing Countdown to Infinite Crisis, and then Final Crisis. These are, like, three of DC's most infamous comics of the last two decades, probably. Like, it's crazy how many people have heard of these, even if they haven't read them. So I want to talk about like what each of our personal experiences is or were with this comic. Like, so I'll go first then, so then you guys know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
So like I first read this comic when it came out. I have the individual issues like, you know, bagged and boarded from 2004 when I was buying comics like religiously. And when I read this, I got to the second issue and I almost canceled every single DC book that I had. Like, almost, like, the next day, went into the store and just canceled them all. But I was like, no, I'm going to stick this out. Maybe they're going to play the theme. Maybe it'll turn into something I like. Because this is before, like, Gritty Comics was overdone. This is before you saw Gritty, you know, in air quotes, Gritty, everywhere. And so I was like, I'm going to stick this out. But then, by December, I had canceled almost everything. Except for, like, the ones that I knew I liked and wanted to keep getting no matter what. I mean, the ones that specifically weren't like this stuff like Action Comics, which is just Superman punching things really hard. That's pretty much all that was left on my pull list, was stuff like that and a couple Marvel titles. But when I've come back to it now, I don't quite feel so volatile against it. And I don't know if it's because modern comics, that whole greediness in comics that came sort of as a wave after this, or I don't know, maybe it's just in my perception that it came after this because this made me realize the trend in greedy comics. I don't know which is the chicken and which is the egg there, but I don't know. I don't feel as volatile against it right now, having just read it. What about you guys? What about you, Jen?
So I knew everything that happened in this beforehand because these storylines are so integral to a lot of what happens later in DC that you kind of have to know them if you want to be able to talk about the overarching DC universe and character development, especially since we have read stuff with Ralph Dibny in it before. And you really have to know his history with Sue to understand his character.
Oh, especially 52.
Oh, yes. So I knew what was coming. I don't think anything prepared me for the horribleness of this. And honestly, like, it was not poorly written. It was really well written. But its clear intent was to make you as unhappy as possible all the time. And I mean, like, yeah, you said it's gritty. It kind of took its cue from the whole kind of we're dark, we're kind of punk, we're on the side of the mainstream vibe that comics were trying to pull off, especially after, like, Frank Miller became really big on the comic scene. And the thing is, I mean, yes, it was incredibly unpleasant to read, but at the same time, I feel like it did what it was trying to do very well. So, I don't know, like, even knowing what was coming, it was still shocking. Let's put it that way.
Okay. And how about you, David?
All right, so I read this right around the time I was starting to read DC stuff that's other than Green Lantern, because I read this probably like 4 or 5 years ago, and I had just started reading. I was like a huge Marvel-only person, but I also read Green Lantern, and then you and I started, Andy, started trading comics a lot, and I had borrowed, formerly known as the Justice League, from you.
Yeah.
And then I read both of the two trades you have. I forget which ones you have. I think there's
formerly
only two.
Known, and then
I can't believe it's not the Justice League.
Yeah, I can't believe that's what it is.
So, and then I started picking up Booster Gold and stuff, and you said, oh, you know, this is you're telling me about your experience with comics and stuff. And I was like, oh, well, you told me how there was one DC event that made you quit comics pretty much. And I was like, oh, well, can I borrow it from you? And you didn't really tell me much about it. I think you wanted me to experience it.
Yes.
And so having just read, I can't believe it's not the Justice League, and formerly known as the Justice League, it's like the exact opposite of Identity Crisis with the same characters.
Yeah. We should read those, because if anybody doesn't know, those are about the old Justice League International team, of which when they talk about how Sue Dibny was an honorary member and how these guys were the backups and became the mainstay players for so long, like, that's the team that they're talking about, is like the Booster Gold, Blue Beetle, Elongated Man, you know, John Jones, like when it was just the backups filling the roster, like Black Canary, Guy Gardner was their Green Lantern when all three or four of them were alive, you know?
Yeah, and like it had like fire and ice and...
Yes. Oh god, fire and ice.
But it was such a happy comic. It was all about the humor, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's also known as Super Buddies. That should tell you what the tone yes. of the comic, right?
That's what they call themselves when they reform, is Super Buddies.
And so then cheesy. I went and read. I pretty much immediately afterwards read Identity Crisis, and it was like, what the hell just happened? Because you don't get any hint of this kind of thing with when you read, you know, other things with Sue Dibny and Ralph. They're not dark characters. They're like more like Scooby-Doo, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, that was Ralph's thing, was solving mysteries, and him and his wife, and they were like this team where, and they would always team up with other kind of lighthearted characters like Beetle and Booster, mm-hmm. you know.
And I mean, I gotta say, as a long-term JLI fan, there's nothing anywhere in the canon that prepares you for this kind of tone. with this team, with these characters, there's nothing that comes anywhere near something that feels like this. And I think a really good indication of that is, like, we kind of gloss over it when we read it, and you kind of gloss over it when you say it. But, like, both Ralph Dibny and Batman call themselves the greatest detective. But Batman says that he solves crime, which implies, like, this sort of undertone of evil and maliciousness. It's crime. It's bad. But Ralph solves mysteries, like fucking Scooby and the gang.
Yeah.
You know, and just that. You can tell the difference.
And that's, you know, there's a, I feel like that's, there's a very important, that plays an important role in the comics medium. Just like TV, there's stuff for everybody. There's comics for everybody. And there are superheroes like Ralph Dibny that, you know, serve a real purpose. They're pointed at a type of audience, or, you know, sometimes you don't want to read the gritty stuff. And so when they, like, yes. Jen said, I feel like it served a purpose for the greater DCU, but it's like, it's disappointing that they took a character like Sue, and this was her end, her departure from the DCU. And it's like, I don't know. I feel like characters like that, if they're going to leave, they should go off into space or something, you know. Go on to some bigger, more grand adventure. Not something like this, you know.
Yeah.
It could have been anybody. And the fact that they... I don't know.
Okay, so let's talk about... I'm gonna introduce you to the incredible research that I've done by quoting Wikipedia.
Nice.
I looked at, like, the reception section for the Wikipedia entry for this, just saying, like, what the critical acclaim was for it, and I'm going to quote it directly. It says, according to Publishers Weekly, this 7-issue miniseries by best-selling author Meltzer was both wildly popular and reviled, which I think is very true. Fan criticism of the series focused on the treatment of Sue Dibny and the retroactive insertion of dark and sexual elements into League history. Other critics, however, defended that exact same trait. And then they quote this guy, Dominic Organ from Comics Bulletin, was critical of the artwork, stating it was incredibly spotty in places, inconsistent, and at times it is downright ugly. However, he was often impressed with the artwork, such as, like, when Batman was racing back to Tim's apartment. And apparently this guy also praised the story, claiming that the standout was the quote-unquote human tragedy of it all. And apparently this comic won an award. This miniseries was selected by the Young Adult Library Series Association for their 2007 recommended list of great graphic novels for teens. Which, that's a whole nother topic. I don't know if I would want my teenager reading this. Like, I don't know if I want my fiance to be reading this, because then she'll think this is what comics are. I don't know about, that's a whole nother topic, but it has won an award. Or been selected for a thing that requires some amount of acclaim. So, but it specifically says in there that the big focus was on Sue Dibny. And like you said, I think Ralph says in here, like, there's people who, you know, like, there's chocolate and vanilla, but there are people who want their butter pecan, you know? And he chose, I like that analogy, because butter pecan is just nutty and sweet. Right, which is like the same kind of feeling you get when you read, say, formerly known as the Justice League. They're nutty, and it's sweet. You know, it's not vanilla like Superman, like Action Comics, running out there and punching stuff. And it's not chocolate like The Boys, which is dark and rich. You know, it's... No, like, seriously, I like that analogy. Yes, but I think the problem with this comic is you pick it up wanting, like, chocolate, but then somebody gets chocolate all over your butter pecan, and it's just a big fucking gunked up mess. Like, you just go, oh, what the fuck? I wanted one or the other. I don't want chocolate butter pecan. I want butter pecan or chocolate. This is so, no.
See, like, this is what I think, you know, they're talking about how the focus was on Sue Dibny, right? I think maybe the intention wasn't to focus it on Sue Dibny, but because they picked such a character that seemed so out of place to be the victim, that it drew focus to that, right?
Yeah.
Because the story is supposed to be about how dark the Justice League is, right? This the majority of the story is about Green. It feels like the focus is on Green Arrow, a lot of it, and yeah, how some members of the Justice League did what had to be done. But you spend, I feel like for me, I got so hung up on Ralph and Sue that it distracts from the other, you know, the rest of it, right?
Yeah, and mm-hmm. I think I'm pretty sure the reason they chose Sue was because they wanted that burst punch to be the hardest. Like, not only is it Sue Dibney of all fucking people, but at the end of the first episode, or the end of the first issue, oh yeah, she was pregnant too. Like, it's not just a big enough gut punch to make it Sue Dibney, but you gotta make her pregnant too.
Consider this. Didn't something similar almost happen to Black Canary? She was held prisoner, beaten, and I think raped or close to rape. Or sexually assaulted in some manner at some point.
Yeah, there was some innuendo in that direction.
And I mean, of course, that brought up all the issues of, like, how do we treat women in comics, but the reader reaction was by no means the same, because here it was more like, oh my god, why would you do that to Sue Dibney? Whereas for Black Canary, it was like, why would you do that to a female comics character? So I think there's also some, like, Sue Dibney seems so innocent and helpless compared to people like, I don't know, Huntress, for instance. Like, you know, if someone killed Huntress, you'd be like, well, that's shitty, but she lived a dangerous life.
Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, it's most likely because Sue is a civilian. And, yeah, she's a sweet civilian and all that. And she goes to the Watchtower and everything, but she's still just a civilian. I mean, to a certain degree, that, I think that's part of the part of the suspended disbelief when you read superheroes with female stars, right? When they're captured by a bunch of really bad people, you know, that's just, you're just gonna, because it's so bad, your mind is going to ignore it and not even go there. And sometimes it'll come up, but only be the lightest implication. It'll never get too serious. It's so, to bring out the psychology degree, when things get too dark, the brain shuts off and ignores it. It's why, like, if you're watching TV, right, and you see home security alarm advertisements, they show you the burglar outside, they give you the noise of the window breaking, and then you hear the alarm and you see the burglar run off. You never see the burglar in the house with the people, because that is too disturbing for too wide of an audience, and people will ignore it, and they will forget your ad. They will push it out of their mind. They will just remove it. So I think your brain removes that part of comics when you read these comics with female leads. You just remove it. It's not necessary. It's too horrific. You don't want to go there. And thinking about it doesn't improve the quality of the comic. So your brain just ignores it and pushes it out. But here, not only do they don't hint at it. They show you. They show you the rape scene. They show you him holding her down.
And, you know, maybe it's a little bit, I don't know, maybe this isn't a thing, but it seems a little bit more disturbing that this guy, Dr. Light, who, you know, he's not a huge villain in the DCU, but he's like he appears a lot. Like, he's a regular Teen Titans villain, right?
Yeah.
He didn't use his powers or anything. It's just like this sick, twisted guy being a sick, twisted guy. Like, I don't know why that came into my mind, but it seems strange that he's not even a supervillain in this. He's just a horrible person.
Right. And that is exactly, so I mean, we're skipping through the notes. I don't care. That's exactly to the point.
Oh, did that come up later?
Dude, whatever, it's fine. That's like exactly the thing that I hate about this comic. I mean, the rape happening, any of these other things that are wrong or right with this comic, that's the thing that I simply cannot abide. If it were a street hooligan, I don't know, maybe it'd have been okay with me. If she were just walking home and some street hooligan pulled her into an alley and did this, right? That happens to real people in real life. But my problem with this comic is that you take something that is fantastical and wonderful with comics, which is the I want to take over the world or get $1 billion kind of superhero, supervillain, right? You take that thing that's corny and fantastic and wonderful and really is a heart of this genre, and you turn it into a rapist. There's no villainy. There's no anything fun. He uses his powers to hold her down harder, and that's it. Like, he burns her wrist a little bit. And the dude's not a villain at that point. You're right. He's straight up just a rapist. And he's straight up just a bad guy.
And he's like a ridiculous looking villain too. Doesn't he have a light bulb on his chest or something? He's like a Mega Man villain.
Something. Yes.
I mean, I think that's pretty much the brunt of what's so horrible about this, that he's goofy. Because the thing about comics is there's safety in the danger. Superman is always going to solve the problem. Even if Superman dies, he'll come back alive. Even if Green Arrow dies, he'll come back alive. And everyone's safe and happy all the time. And then suddenly you bring a real-world issue, like rape, into the picture, and it's suddenly not a fantasy anymore. Because, yeah, there are bad people out there, but in reality, it's not Lex Luthor going all mustache twirly and being like, oh, I'm going to take over the world. Bad people
and rape your wife.
Do horrible things.
And see, yeah. This is something that no amount of, like, Kryptonian technology, magic, super editor retcon powers will never erase. This is something that is forever, you know? Superman died back in the 90s, and it's completely irrelevant now.
Yeah.
If they brought back Ralph and Sue in the New 52, this would still be there, even if it was retconned to not happen. Well, this happened.
Even if it's not part of the canon, right? It's going to be the very first thing that every single person will comment on. Is remember when she got raped? Remember when she got killed by Jean Loring? Like, this will forever be part of Justice League International. Like, that whole group, this is what you'll think of when you think of them. I don't know. Is there anything redeeming about that part of this comic? Because, I mean, it's really easy to trash on it. It is. And that's, I mean, let's be honest. We picked these three comics that we're going to do in the next 3 weeks because they're considered letdowns. And we want to trash on them because people like hearing us trash on things. But is there rationalization for this? Could this be a compelling story without the rape? Could you rationalize everything else that happens if it weren't something as horrible as this? Is it at least necessary?
No, I don't. I'll go ahead, Jen. Sorry.
I think, yeah, you could rationalize it because her death is horrible and we're supposed to know that. On the other hand, you know, it was certainly meant to shock and horrify and sadden, and it did that. But it does bring to mind an issue that's real. And, I mean, there is some value in that, even if it's executed more for shock than anything. That's all.
Okay,
I'm going to say I disagree with that. I don't think the rape is necessary at all. The whole rape, in the grand scheme of the plot of this comic, is so they can make Dr. Light a red herring, okay? Because if we think about it, this story is that that Jean Loring killed Sue Dibney. Dr. Light comes into it because they wanted to do this whole thing where they mind wiped somebody, right? Mm-hmm. They could have picked some other crime. They even show other crimes because they make those other guys forget their identities.
Green Arrow even has to rationalize it to Wally because Wally is Barry's successor and Wally wasn't there when this happened. And Wally, of almost everybody in that group, I think, true to his character, is the most true person in that he will not let them do something that is wrong. And at the same time, that bites him in the butt. Like, later on, when Clark comes up and asks him about it, he also will not rat out on his friends. He is... That is true for his character, and I like that he was portrayed that way.
I feel like the rape scene and Dr. Light and stuff, I feel like what that... The plot point that drove towards was the fact that the Justice League had to do bad things too, mm-hmm. right? And so I feel like it could have been something else. It didn't have to be a rape.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think, you're right. Just speaking in terms of mechanics of a story, it didn't necessarily have to be rape. They show you perfectly other good reasons why it had to happen and why it had to happen multiple times when Ollie explains it to Barry. He says, look, remember when they switched our bodies? You think they didn't take pictures? You think they didn't figure out who we all were? You think nobody ever figured this out? Like, people did figure this out, and there's only one way to fix that. You throw them in Arkham, you throw them anywhere, they're going to tell everybody. Either you cut out their tongue, or you mind wipe them. And if you mind wipe them, at least they can go on with their world. And it sucks for Dr. Light that he was the first one and we fucked up, but we got better at it. And you do need to do it. So, I mean, speaking of mechanics, yeah, you can still rationalize, quote, air quotes, however much you can rationalize mind wiping a person. But to get the investment from the reader, does that work? Because part of the reason this comic gets you riled up is that this is so horrible. Because the other big one that they take more than one panel to explain is the body switching. They show like 3 or 4 panels of the body switching, and everything else just gets like a mention. Because that's a really serious threat. But that's also like, we're magic and there's a crystal ball and it's going to swap our bodies. It's still the fantastic-y, you know, $1 billion supervillain. It's still regular old supervillainy. There is no dirty underbelly here. Because then they haven't done anything wrong, right? The supervillains haven't at that point done anything like devious and dark. They've done what they've always been doing. They're just trying to beat the superheroes. They haven't done anything to merit or deserve something to the same degree as, basically, I think you put it in the notes, Jen, mind rape, right? Like, they're getting mind raped, and that's a different degree of moral punishment than what happens. So it's like, in terms of emotional mechanics to make the story work, you have to make it just as bad. And it seems like the only way this comic can justify rape is with rape. And I'm sorry that I stole your thunder by reading your comment there, Jen.
That's fine. I mean, the only thing I would add to that is it's a very common idea in our society that we really like to perpetuate, you know, that it's okay to rape someone if they've raped someone else already, because we always say, like, oh, he's going to get what he deserves in prison, with a little chuckle at the end, you know. Mm-hmm. And here, it's interesting because it's taking that really common idea, which people tend not to question because we see it as justice, and then just throwing it out there like it's all good. But then it overturns it with Wally saying, like, what the fuck are you doing? You can't do that just because he, you know, did that to her. You can't change his personality. We have a justice system for a reason.
So this is the last point about the rape, and then I swear we will try to move on. Because I know there is more in this comic than the rape scene. But I'm sorry, it is the most pivotal part of this comic, or at the very least, it's the most memorable part of this comic, and not in the positive way. But to me, we've read 2 years of comics, and 2 years and change. And we've read a bunch of stuff that's considered gritty, or written off as gritty. I think one of the... like, in our second series, we read Preacher, which is, like, super gritty. There's some dirty shit that happens in there. You know, and, like, we've read The Boys, and we've read all kinds of other stuff written by Warren Ellis, basically. But for all of that, this one feels like it's, to me, it feels the most gritty because of that juxtaposition of nostalgia for this idealized period. It's like this 70s, 80s period of comics that we all have this nostalgic feeling for, so much so to the point that DC is even moving their universe back in that direction. They're moving their storytelling back to get back to that point that the fan base has nostalgia for. And so it's like they peeled back the curtain on that thing that you loved and showed you, oh, wait, there's rape back there. There's this thing behind the curtain that makes all of those stories really fucking dark. And if you wanted to do a gritty comic, I feel like this succeeds there. But I don't know if I wanted that. Okay.
Let's talk about something not rape.
Okay. All right. Let's see. God, there's so much.
Deathstroke fight.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. I loved that, that scene. Cool. You know what's funny is I was thinking about this fight before I read the comic, and I was trying to remember what it was in, and for some reason I kept thinking it was in that thing with Roy Harper where he swings the cat.
With the dead drug cat or whatever?
Yeah, for some reason I kept thinking that fight was from that comic, and I must have blocked it out the rest of this.
See what I mean about the brain blocking out horrible things?
Yeah. I mean, because I think that's a great fight scene.
It is. It is a really good fight scene for a lot of it. The thing that just gets me is the bit with Kyle Rayner. I don't know. Sucks. Like, I know Kyle Rayner, like, for the longest time, had these sort of security issues with his character. But by the time this comes out, that was, like, years ago. By the time this comes out, the guy has been Ion, which is basically a god status. He's rebuilt entire solar systems. He has reignited the power battery in Oa. He started up the Guardians again. And, oh, yeah, he created a whole new... He single-handedly created Guardians of the Universe. At this point, I don't think the guy should have confidence issues. It felt a little out of place.
Hey, Slade's pretty scary. He's kind of a scary dude.
Yeah, but...
No. Green Lantern, who is well-trained, is like the most powerful force in the universe.
Yeah, Green Arrow even says it in the narration. He says he calls him the most powerful weapon in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like that Slade just stops him by covering his hand.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem right. You know why it doesn't seem right? Because in the comics, in the Green Lantern now, there is a reptile dude, okay? All his limbs were chopped off. And he put the ring on his tail and kept fighting.
Oh.
And his like, his limbs are now growing back. But see, it seems like...
And like, even like I think the first thing is... Deathstroke, like, grabs his hand, and Ollie says, oh, and he breaks all four of his fingers instantaneously. Like, the ring wouldn't let that happen. It just wouldn't. Like, immediately, no, that's not Green Lantern. I'm sorry. No.
Well, yeah, because it's like his shield is gone all of a sudden.
Yeah, like, what, did it just go away because Slade looked at him with his eyeball?
In the top panel, he still has the shield on, and then it's gone. I don't know. I think the best the person who came out on top in this whole fight was Green Arrow.
Yes, he suddenly looks really badass.
At this part, you're like, okay, Ollie is not just some fucking stupid Robin Hood thing. He's kind of a badass. You know why? You know why I think he succeeded? Because he's an old man. Also, it was an old man fight.
None of them young whippersnappers were gonna get in the way.
Yeah,
I do like how Ollie writes it off later. Oh yeah, I meant to stab him in his bad eye, just to remind him. Salt in the wound.
Yeah.
Sure. That's exactly what it was, Ollie. I'm sure. On purpose.
It was a little weird, though, that, Slade can predict all of their movements all the time, except for the one time Green Arrow's, like, stabbing him in the eye with an arrow. Like, you think he'd be able to know that was going to happen?
Well, but Ollie got the drop on him.
I guess. I mean, he's not prescient. He's just smart.
I think he thought that. He probably figured he took Ollie out of the fight because he doesn't have his bow and arrow anymore. You know what I mean? Like, he can't use the arrows for shooting.
Yeah.
But he can still use them for stabbing.
Yeah.
Like how the Flash got stabbed through the chest and he's like, okay, somehow.
Well, he has the healing metabolism thingy-majigger.
Does he?
Yeah, he does. It's a thing.
Okay. I wasn't aware of that.
It's a thing. He has, like, a healing thing, like, because every part of his body is fast.
Right. You know, the Flash has to eat all the time, right? How come you never see him eating?
You know, I do like that they did that in the cartoon, though.
Yeah, because I remember that Wally had to, like, eat nonstop.
They did it in some of the Wally West comics, like, before they brought Barry Allen back. Like, they would show him eating all the time. Like, whenever he was in costume, he'd be eating. But, like, even in the Justice League Unlimited show, they show him, like, eating 400 hot dogs in costume, like, on the street at a hot dog vendor. But, yeah. So, there were other fights in this, too, right? Like, when they went out and tried to hunt everybody down, was any of that memorable? Because I gotta say, I was reading this and I was like, oh yeah, this is where Firestorm died.
That made me so sad. Like, they only give it like one panel too. That was the worst part. Because I felt like that was like really poignant. And
yeah, it was a really well done scene.
That could have had its own comic. That upset me.
It probably did. There was probably a crossover somewhere.
Maybe. It's just...
but like, I remember reading Blackest Night and I was like, wait, when did Firestorm die? And then I read this and I'm like, I realized I did know when Firestorm died. I just didn't remember or care or pushed it out of my mind because of the thing I mentioned earlier.
That's another thing about this comic. You forget everything else that happened if you're a reasonable person.
So does that make this like a comic for psychopaths?
Maybe.
I don't know. Maybe we're just too soft.
We're sensitive?
Yeah.
I don't know, because I feel like we tolerated things like Preacher and The Boys pretty well.
Yeah, but see, the thing, this is what I think. The thing with comics like that is you know what you're getting into. When you pick up a comic with Superman shedding a single tear like he's in some kind of environmental commercial, you remember that thing with the Indian? With
the Indian by the side of the road? Yes.
Yeah. I don't expect what happened to happen. You know, okay, Superman's been sad lots of times.
Okay, I've got a good analogy, right? So when you pick up The Boys and read all that stuff in The Boys, you expect it. But when you pick this up, you don't expect it. It's kind of like, say you picked up Grand Theft Auto or Saints Row. You expect to have to go in and break up a hooker riot with satchel charges. Like, you're looking forward to that. You know okay. It's going to happen. You don't, like, buy Viva Pinata and expect rape. Right? Like, you don't buy Viva Pinata and expect this level of grittiness.
You know, Viva Pinata is surprisingly violent. Just put that out there.
Okay, well, I don't know. Some other, like, somewhat fluffy kids' game.
Well, think about it. Wasn't there... There was, like, a... It wasn't really... In The Boys, it wasn't really, like... I guess you could call it a rape, because it was forced sexual relations, right? The part where...
I'm pretty sure that's the definition.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not the same. I feel like I'm a Republican now.
Oh, God.
Do you know what I mean, though? Like, it's not...
Yeah.
What's her name? What's the girl's name from the Seven? The new girl, whatever her name is.
Yeah, the
Huey's
one with
girlfriend.
Yeah.
You know, when she first arrives, Captain America... What is that guy? See, I can't even remember the guy's name.
Oh,
Captain America Superman. I remember the
leader of the Seven.
Yeah.
And he's like... He drops his pants in front of her, and he's like, you want to join the team, right? But...
Oh, that.
The first thing we see in The Boys is a superhero ripping some person's arm off because he's being careless.
Yeah.
So then that really sets the tone for this comic. But Justice League's had decades of tone setting, and then all of a sudden, this is what we get, right? We're going back to the rape again. We're trying not to talk about it.
Well, I think we can segue this into the art too. Then I think the art does a really good job of trying to set the tone, and it just doesn't do it enough. And I think you're right. I think it's because there's decades of tone setting here, and to be fair, we should have expected something like this, right? I don't know what the cover of the trade is, but the cover of issue one is single-tier Superman and them all standing over a coffin, right? And I don't know if it's because we've been desensitized to superhero death, but...
I think that's exactly what it is.
But, I mean, you look at the cover, you can tell this isn't, like, a normal death cover, even. Like, normal quote-unquote, normal death covers in superhero comics is somebody, like, on their knees with the person in the arms. Like, I think of the Supergirl in the arms of Superman in Countdown to...
Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yeah, Crisis on Infinite Earths. Like, that's the one I think of. Or, like, you see, like, Spider-Man's grave, and it says, rest in peace, all dramatically, like, for Kraven's last hunt, you know? Like, it's... Even if it's a death, it's still... dramatic somehow. It's over the top. It's like they're action-y. It's boom, in your face, death. Ah, fucker. But this is like, oh, sad. I don't know why I'm picking up the comic and pointing it at my computer screen.
I know what you mean, right? Like, usually when it's the death of some person's arch enemy succeeds, right?
Yeah. And I think the interior penciler and inker, Rags Morales and Michael Blair and, fuck, I don't know, the colorist. Sorry. I think they do a good job of trying, even inside the comic, to let you know this isn't entirely normal. One of the things that I noticed as I was reading this is that you can always see the eyes behind the mask. You can always see them. Like, when Green Arrow's there, in most comics, when they put on the mask, the eyes become white, or the eyes become black. In this comic, everybody who is in this group, you can see their eyes. You can see Wally's eyes under the mask. You can see Ollie's eyes under the mask. You can see Kyle Rayner's under the mask. The only one that you sometimes don't see is Bruce Wayne, Batman, because he wasn't in on it. I mean, there are these subtle things in the art which makes you think they're showing us what's behind the mask. They're showing us what's behind the curtain. They're showing us the gritty realism of what happens as part of the League, because the League endures. You have to do things like this. But it almost feels like that's too subtle. I don't know. Every indication tells me we should have expected this, but I didn't. I didn't then, and I still, when I'm reading this, it still doesn't hit me right. Is there anything in the art with you guys that falls either way here?
I found the art to be really off-putting in a way that was not conducive to the storytelling. I mean, kind of the core stuff was good, but at the same time it was distracting from the drama, because there were things like the faces looked really strange to me, or it was the ink work was too heavy and too dark, and instead of it just lending atmosphere, it made it feel more like this was kind of a rush job, I guess. So instead of saying, like, wow, you know, the art here just goes in tune with the words so well, it's more like, the writing here is really strong. Ooh, what's happening with the art? Why the fuck is Kyle Rayner on all the steroids? What happened to his head? So, I mean, the art looked weird enough to me to look almost humorous, and I thought that was completely inappropriate to the tone of the comic itself.
All I can do is sigh. I think you're right. I didn't even notice that how the inking is heavy. And while the inking is heavy, the coloring is bright. And, I mean, conceptually, theoretically, that's exactly what it should be, right? The underlying foundation of this comic is dark and heavy, but it's covered in the sheen of bright colors, you know? Like, thematically speaking, that should be perfect. Right, like, that fits the theme of the comic. The art is the way of the theme of the comic. It should be. Why doesn't it work? I just don't understand why it doesn't work. Although I will say that panel where Dr. Light, like, realizes that he had been fucked, and, like, you turn the page and it's just this big, full, like, yellow page, and you just get, like, the brief, like, the most light outlines of Dr. Light's face. That page was sick, and I completely forgot that page existed, but now when I came back to it, I'm like, that is a really good panel where you can see the expression in the dude's face when he's like, not only have I been wronged, but I've been wronged in the most vile of ways, and I am so fucking angry.
This comic actually does a really good job of conveying emotion through faces. Like, we haven't even talked about this yet, but the part where Tim Drake's father dies, and Batman's, like, rushing back to the house.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Batman looks frightened. And you don't see Batman look like that very often. And so, I think, for the most part, the art is pretty decent. I think it makes characters that you wouldn't think of as frightening, it makes them pretty scary. Like, even so, I just talked about the Batman panel in issue 5. On the very next page, it shows Captain Boomerang, and he looks, and he's like a joke up until this point in the comic, and he looks pretty menacing coming through the door.
Yeah, he's got his game face on.
I think this is page 28 of issue 5, at least in my version, which has ads too, so. But I think, yeah, the art is pretty good for the most part. I think it does a good job of like I said, at least conveying emotion.
Right. And the panel that... There are two panels in this, and one panel that sort of echoes a panel in this one that comes in 52. But the two in this that, through my years of trying to forget this comic, the two panels that have always stuck in my head, right, is the one of Ralph Dibny's face melting, practically, as he's up there trying to muster up the strength to give a eulogy. And he just breaks down and he says, "I can't." And his face just... Like, his face is literally falling apart because he's elongated, man. Like, it's what happens. It literally falls apart. That sticks in my mind because it's so effectively drawn, and it can only be done with that character. And the other one, the one that they echo in 52, is earlier than that, when Ralph discovers Sue and just wraps her completely in the rain. Like, that scene, my fucking God. And yeah. I don't know if that's necessarily the art, but I'll tell you, in that scene... Wherever you want to nitpick this art, it doesn't get in the way of that scene. There's so much power behind that scene. It's insane.
Another one is the whole series of panels in issue 7 where Jean Loring tries to convince Ray Palmer that she did the right thing.
Yeah, the I'm not crazy.
Yeah. Especially on page 12, where the top of page 12, where she's got like this desperate smile on her face.
Yeah. Yeah, those facial expressions, that, and it has to be so good, and it's done. That is really well done.
And you can see the transition in her. She goes from happy to, like, confused, then she's desperate, and then she eventually just looks freaking evil.
Yeah, that's when she gets that's when she gets crazy face.
Yeah.
So do we want to talk, we should talk about that, the whole, you know, basic plot of the story. What did you guys think of that, of Jean Loring being the killer? I mean, and when I read it in 2004, I didn't feel this way, but now I feel like it's just, damn, women's be crazy. Women be crazy.
I'll go ahead, James.
Well, it's supposed to be a mystery, right? Because it revolves around Ralph Dibny, who is a detective, and he solves mysteries. We're supposed to find the killer. And a general rule for a good mystery is that the audience must be able to solve it, but it should be hard enough that it's not obvious to them. You have to give your audience clues, yet not actually show them what's happening. So at the end, when it's revealed, they go, "Oh my God, I should have known that all along." And in this case, it was kind of like, you kind of get a sense that it's maybe I only got that sense that it was happening because I knew who did it. But it was kind of out of the blue. Like, she doesn't seem crazy. She doesn't seem desperate. In fact, the whole time, he's the one who seems desperate. So why is she struggling so hard to get him back? And why does it justify killing Sue Dibny? Why does it justify threatening Lois Lane? Why does it justify getting Tim Drake's dad killed? It doesn't make sense in that way.
Yeah, and I think part of the difficulty for me with her is that in the same way that there's nothing about her character that makes you think this is what happened to Sue Dibny, there's nothing in Jean Loring's character that makes you think she's going to be crazy for Ray Palmer like this. I mean, they were a happy couple for a long time, but they weren't like Animal Man and his wife, you know? They weren't like Ray Palmer and Sue Dibny. They were always a little bit off. They were more the quote-unquote typical American marriage with its bumps and difficulties. And it's like, okay, yeah, they get a divorce. I understand that. I mean, they're not Dinah and Ollie or Hal and...
Carol.
I mean, they're not those couples. They're not that severe. You know, they're civilized enough. They can get married and then when it's not working, get a divorce. But there's nothing that prepares you for this streak of crazy that just comes out of nowhere. Because they're getting the divorce. There's nothing. There's nothing that brings you up to that. I don't know. That feels out of place for me. There's so much that feels out of place, but I don't know.
No.
I honestly,
go on.
The Jean Loring story, I didn't have a problem. I didn't have any problems with that. I just feel like we could have got there by taking a different path. And I think I've probably said that based on what I've said throughout this whole episode. You guys probably know why I feel that way, but like, I didn't have a problem with that. I think that's okay. Normal people can do bad things too, and Gene Loring's pretty normal, right?
Yeah. Okay, so wait, there's only one thing on the notes that we haven't talked about yet. And it's the fact that in Gotham, nobody can have parents.
Yeah, seriously.
Except Barbara Gordon.
Except Barbara. And the only reason she can have a parent is because he's the commissioner of the entire police force. It's the only way. If your dad's not a commissioner, you're fucked. Sorry. I felt like, really, come on, if everybody, Tim Drake, you gotta mind that Batman parents mine again? Okay. Go ahead. All yours. I don't know, maybe it's, I'm wrong. Do you guys feel differently?
I think that Tim Drake's dad should have gotten hit with the boomerang and he should have pulled through. I don't think he should have died. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, is there any emotional payoff to that scene when you read it here? Is there any story mechanic that is heightened by that happening?
No, because you know what? All the emotional payoff comes in when they're driving to go see the dad.
Yeah.
And they're saying their goodbyes to each other like it's the last time they'll see each other, and Tim's freaking out, and Batman is scared and afraid for him. And that is a really good scene. But the tension's there, and it doesn't... I mean, there's a good payoff, that panel where Batman is holding Tim, and he's like, you know, I've got you.
But yeah, it's okay, I'm here.
I mean, that could have been the case even if his dad was alive. The payoff comes before the death, so the death didn't really need to occur.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's a great way of putting it. And for me, the payoff artistically and story-wise doesn't come there. The payoff comes with Gene Loring. I think the Gene Loring thing, as much as I harped on it before about how this doesn't come out of, and this comes out of left field for Gene Loring, it still feels more organic than this. This feels, I don't know, this feels like it comes from a DC editor more than it comes from the writing. I don't know. Okay. Does anybody have anything else to say before we rate this? All right.
Silence.
Going, gone. I'll go first.
Actually, wait, I do want to say something.
Okay, then you can go first after you're done.
At the end of issue 7, when Ralph is by himself in his apartment, I actually loved that part where he's talking to Sue.
That made me so sad.
It was very sad, but I felt like, okay, if there was going to be a happy ending to this comic, that was it. It made me feel good.
That's poignant, happy, and sad all at the same time.
Yeah. It left me with a good feeling inside at the end of that. Even though it was like... It was so soul-crushing up until this, I feel like, okay, this payoff, this is okay. They got the... I think they just made the happiest ending they could. And so, I at least I feel like it ended on a good note. So that's what I had to say. I don't know if you guys have anything to add to that.
No, that sums it up.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a great scene because he loves her so much, and the first stage is denial, and that's where he's at. All right, David, you go first. You get to rate this first.
Oh, God, this is hard to rate, actually. Because, so this is the second time I've read this. I feel like, in general, it's a pretty good story. So, I'm going to give it a 3.5. I feel like they could have gone... I think they could have had the same story and had different things happen along the way. But I think overall, it's a good comic. You know, the story is pretty decent. Like, and I thought that Gene Loring was a good villain at the end. As far as comic book fights go, there's some good ones. And it ended for me, it ended okay. But as we've said throughout this whole thing, the rape is just it knocks it down a few pegs for me.
It dominates any discussion of the comic.
Yeah. And I think that's why it's hard to see that this actually is a pretty good story after only one read. And I think, like you said about the Tim Drake thing, it's like being an orphan is a prerequisite to being Robin. And it's and the editors were like, oh man, you know what? We should have made Tim Drake an orphan. Let's take care of that right now. And on top of that, we'll make another orphan by killing Captain Boomerang. And so now his son is an orphan too. It's like, okay, guys.
Orphans, everyone.
Yeah.
You get a dead parent.
Yeah, Oprah, like Oprah, right? So I think if you didn't read this and you're just listening to our discussion, read it, give yourself a week, and then read it again and see if you agree or disagree with us.
That is good advice.
But like I said, I'm gonna give it a 3.5. I think it's got some low points, but overall it's not bad.
Okay. So
that's it for me. I don't hate it as much as I hated it the first time.
Yeah, I'll go next, if that's all right, Jen.
Go for it.
I'm going to give this a 3. God, there's some scenes where I feel like I want to give it so much more. There are some scenes where the payoff is incredible. Where, like that scene with Gene Loring, the payoff is incredible. There's payoff down the road that's awesome. There's payoff that just... There are scenes that are fucking fantastic in this that just melt you the way that exactly they're supposed to. And then there are scenes that just make you want to tear the comic book in half because they're so stupid, useless, put in by an editor so clearly. Or even if not put in by an editor, it looks like it is, in which case that's a big problem too. There are so many scenes that just make you as angry as the scenes that work, and not angry in a way that I feel like they're supposed to. Because Sue dying should make you angry. Bad things happening to Sue should make you angry, but it shouldn't make you angry because of this. It shouldn't make you angry because they've destroyed the suspended disbelief of superheroes and supervillains. It makes you angry not because she got you raped. It makes you angry because they've destroyed the entire prerequisite that you've built in your head for what a comic book is. They take it and they throw it out the door. And that makes me want to give this the worst rating ever. But Gene Loring! But the rest, everything around that is so good. I mean, granted, some of the art sucks and some of the like Deathstroke fight scene details are wrong and stupid, and I'll push up my nerd glasses on my nose, but... 3. Just for everything that's done right, that if nothing else, that just kills it for me. It just makes this the worst thing I have ever read, and that's why I wanted to put it first, so that when I complain about other things, I can say at least it's not as bad as Identity Crisis. It's just the worst. Oh God, and we didn't even talk about it. I just realized the payoff when you find out that Batman also got mind wiped. We didn't even talk about that really. Which I feel like an ass for not bringing it up until right now during my section, so I'm the one who gets to talk. But, like, when they tell you that they mind-wiped him and then they show you him solving a crime, like, that scene works because you're like, God, he solves these crimes and you get a feeling he solved it, but what is it doing to him? If he solved it, what is doing it to him? And if he doesn't know that, if he never figured that out, if he never got a hint of it, how does that diminish him? What is that? But then... 3. I'm just going to go in circles. 3.
Okay,
Jen.
Okay, 3.5. And I honestly liked the writing at the, you know, basic sentence level. I thought the comic started off strongly. You know, the way that he's... Like, they play with time really nicely. I really enjoyed how he's talking about the difference between solving a mystery and solving something that involves a villain. And suddenly we, you know, that's the whole plot, and that's kind of neat. It's a good introduction. The end was so touching, where Green Arrow's like, talk to her, and he actually takes him up on that advice. And, like, you feel like he's beginning to heal, which ties in with the whole idea of life goes on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a fair lesson. And even some of the really bad stuff, I don't mind when they kill off good characters in shows, as long as it's done for a purpose. It can't just be like, oh, we're going to shock you. And it has to have a good emotional impact. The problem is they killed off too many people here. And there was too much bad. And what either happens is you put it down because you can't cope with it, or you numb yourself to it, and then it kind of all blends together. And you say, like, oh, this is just really painful to read, but it's too much shock value. I think a better way is to play with your audience's highs and lows. So maybe give them a little bit of hope that something good's going to happen, and then let them down. But you can't just be in the ditch the entire time in terms of narrative. The art, I mean, I kind of spoke my piece about that. I feel like it's kind of wonky. It's overwrought. I thought some of the scenes were really well done. Like, I like Batman comforting Tim when he finds his father dead. That was a really touching scene. Or when Ralph, like this little detail in the very end of issue 7, he reaches and stretches out his arm to the other side of the bed and turns off his wife's nightstand light for her. And it's just like, he turned it on for her in the first place too. That's just really sweet. So, I mean, the art was kind of up and down for me. So was the writing. So 3.5.
Okay. I gotta say, I'm really surprised, talking about this comic, how much I want to apologize for it, considering how long I've hated it to death. So I really, anybody who hasn't read this or just read it once, I honest to God, David, that was some amazing advice, saying read it, put it down, and read it again in like a week. Like that, like I read it and put it down for 8 years and picked it up, and I'm amazed at how differently I'm coming at it. That's good advice.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So next week we're going to read Countdown to Infinite Crisis. This should be relatively easy to find. You can find it for like $1 or $1.50. I think at some point they even handed it out to free to people. But it's only a single issue. It's 80 pages, so it's a big issue. But it's even a single issue. Written by Jeff Johns, Greg Rucka, and Judd Winnick. So it's kind of an all-star writing team for DC. Art by Rags Morales, Ed Benes, Phil Jimenez, Ivan Rice, and Jesus Saez, with additional art by Jimmy Palmiotti, Mike Baer, Mark Campos, and Andy Lanning. I mean, there are a lot of really, really notable names with the art, with writing, with the help, everyone. Covered by Jim Lee and Alex Ross. So, like, dude, just crazy. So we're going to read those 80 pages for next week, and hopefully we can fill an hour based off of analyzing 80 pages.
If we can.
I'm pretty sure we can. So that's what we're going to do next week. If you want to figure out how to buy that, or you want to know what's going to come after that, or even the week after that, we got quite a bit up in store for you guys coming up. You can hit us up on our website, which is www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com. You can also ask us directly through our email address, which is
AtomicPoweredSupercast@gmail.com.
Oh, I knew if I just threw it out there, somebody would catch it. Like the Sandlot. You just hit it up and you land it right in that glove.
I love that movie, by the way.
Fucking great. Fucking great. My fiance hasn't seen it. It's on the list. We're going to have to watch it. The other way, of course, you know, I don't really email anybody anymore. Nobody really uses email anymore. We have one anyway, but I know everybody's got the social medias with the Twitters and the Facebooks. So you can message us that way. It's facebook.com/APSupercast or twitter.com/APSupercast, whichever is you all fancy. We will respond to you there. And as always, please subscribe to us on
iTunes.
Yeah. Man, I always get so awkward during the outro. It's fucking wonderful and horrible. So yeah. Is that it? Is that everything?
I think that's it.
Sick. Until next week, everybody. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.